This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we are going to begin some conversations that focus in on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which is coming up next week, as a matter of fact. And the first one we talk about is from Valparaiso University, and the programs and celebration or convocation, however you want to put it, is entitled Our Time, and we'll find out more about that. Byron Martin is the Executive Director of International and Intercultural Engagement at Valparaiso University, and he is in the studio with us today. Byron, thank you for joining us here.
No, thank you for having me. I really do appreciate it.
Well, I like the way that the I should mention, too, that there's a website out there on the Valparaiso University, Valparaiso University website, valpo.edu, that goes into great more detail about the celebration. And I like one of the front pages of the celebration says that Dr. King, of course, referring to Martin Luther King Jr., Dr. King once famously said, "The time is always ripe to do right." And as mentioned there about it being an often misquoted phrase, why would that be misquoted?
Well, a lot of times it's misquoted because people typically say the time is always right to do right, or it's always a good time to do right. But King was really, in that time, really talking directly about the fruits of the work that was happening during the civil rights movement. And he was making a deliberate point to use the word ripe to signify that the fruits are always good when we're doing justice inside the world, and it's always the right time to make that happen. And so I think King was very specific with his wording, and sometimes we just misquote King to use it for our own good, and we don't necessarily always get the meat behind it. King was taking some time there to talk to the liberals and the moderates at that time that were telling him just to be still, slow down. You don't, it'll eventually come, right? Justice will eventually come. Civil rights will eventually come. Just slow down. You just got to give it time. Just give it time. You don't have to keep fighting. You don't need to keep marching and doing this work. You don't need to keep having these difficult conversations. Just slow down. And so King's like, whoa, no, the time is always ripe to do what is right. The time is always here that we need to be fighting for justice and moving forward. And so he was very clear on that in tons of his writings. We even get the sense of that with his letter from Birmingham jail that is so famous. And so King was really making a point there to encourage people that, hey, there's work to be done right now. And that's what we're doing with this day as well.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask, how does this fit in the Our Time concept with what's planned for this year's program on campus?
Yeah, I think right now we're sitting in a milieu in our nation where we need to rededicate ourselves to a healthy sense of our moral obligations and remember that justice has to be our guiding light. And it's our time to step up, especially talking to our younger generations. We're a university, so students are our bread and butter. That's how we exist. That's why we exist. And so informing our students, first and foremost, that it's their time, right? It's their time to begin to think deeply and critically about what's affecting the world and where these gaps inside the lived experiences of people in the world are coming from, and to do something about it, and to begin to activate and to actually make moves to help shape the world that we're going to exist in. So when we say it's our time, it's each individual's time, right? Everybody's time is now to do the call for justice and to respond to it.
I know the program that's going to be happening, the convocation that follows the program as part of the day on Monday, January 20th, on the Valparaiso University campus, is going to start out with a lot of discussion, a lot of sessions getting together, people talking about these topics. Run us through the schedule and let us know what is planned to come up, starting in, I guess, with the welcome, which is going to happen on Monday morning.
Right. We start off every day with our MLK Day. We consider it a full day on, and so there are several events that folks can come and be a part of. We started 8:30 in the morning with a welcome that it is just acts as an energizer, gets people kind of motivated for the day. At 9:30, we go into our focus sessions, and we have actually five options for focus sessions that individuals can take in. And in the focus sessions, the first three that you'll know, that you'll see on the schedule are representation and access, allyship, justice, faith, and forgiveness. Those three serve as kind of small TED Talks during this time. So you'll get an opportunity to hear from several speakers during that time that are talking about the theme of that particular track. And then we have what we call our anchor speakers, our plenary speakers for each of those tracks that are content experts in those arenas. And we have some great speakers there. Representation and Access will actually be having our Chief Diversity Officer, our Associate Provost for Inclusion and Retention. Dr. Stacey Miller would be the keynote on that track. For Allyship, we have a avid thinker and community organizer out of Dallas that's going to be flying up and spending time with us for the conversation on allyship. His name is Russell Kirby. And then for Justice, Faith, and Forgiveness, we actually have somebody from here in Northwest Indiana, Reverend John Jackson from UCC Gary, that'll be the anchor on that track. And then we have opportunity for folks that want to engage in a training to know how do we have these discussions, how do we go deeper into these discussions, to join us in our Can I series that we host on the campus of Valparaiso University. Can I is an acronym for Creating and Nurturing Inclusivity, and it's a series that was developed by me and my counterpart Janelle Love, and we developed this curriculum to bring our entire campus through this series. It's a three-level series that they can engage in. We'll give you 1.1 on MLK Day that folks can engage in. And then we started this last year, but our K through 8 option. So we wanted to have an opportunities for children to actually engage at their level in these conversations. And so we have a great K through 8 option that parents can sign their kids up for. They can go to the focus sessions, and then the children can go to the K through 8 where they'll be shepherded through some of this content as well.
So it sounds like you have the whole family involved, I guess, if they come over
for the
convocation later.
Oh, yeah. And then we have a luncheon, and so the luncheon is open to the community. It's only $12, and the theme that we're pushing at the luncheon is sustainability. So everybody has foods inside their lived experience that come out of a distressed situation. And so we're actually going to be featuring some of those foods, some of the tricolor potatoes. When there's a potato shortage, you just take whatever potatoes you have, put it together, and you make a dish, right? Like, we all have those dishes in our cultural heritage. And so we're going to be talking about that and talking about sustainability at lunch and what does that mean. And then we run right into our convocation featuring Dr. Imani Perry. And so, now
tell us about Dr. Perry. She's a very interesting speaker, very, very knowledgeable in her own right. And it's great that you have an opportunity to get somebody like that to come to the Valparaiso University campus for a day like this.
Yeah, no, Dr. Perry is a huge get for us. Dr. Perry is the Hughes Rogers Professor for African American Studies and Faculty Associate in the program in Law and Public Affairs and Gender and Sexuality Studies at Princeton University. So, and her title is not even as immense as her work, literally. She's done some incredible things inside of the community there. And as a thinker, as somebody that engages the broader nation in what does it mean to be just, what does it mean to be a healthy community, and her influence on race and law and literature has just been through the roof. And so we're excited to have her. We're going to have her on deck with us that day and talking on our theme topic, Our Time, as well as we'll also have an opportunity for folks to engage and buy her book. Her newest book out is called Breathe, A Letter to My Sons, and that was just released in September of this past year. And so it's an opportunity to engage with her and the author, and that book is basically a letter that she's writing to her sons, and just things that she wants them to know, things that she wants them to feel and wants them to experience, but also things that she wants them to be aware of. And so she's an amazing author, thinker, and we're excited to have her with us to help encourage our community and challenge us through some incredible thoughts.
I actually had a chance to visit some other communities here in the Midwest and talk to them as well, or is this a first-time visit for her to this region?
Yeah, I am not sure. I want to say I know it's her first time to Valpo, and we're excited to have her here at Valpo. I'd probably say probably her first time in Northwest Indiana, but I don't know how extensively she's been in this area. I know we were chatting not too long ago. We were chatting about some of her travels, so she's definitely well-traveled and been around and is a sought-after speaker.
It sounds like that this is going to be a very, very enlightening and inspirational day, to be sure. And it kind of leads up to the MLK Awards. Right. Tell us a little bit about that and how it fits in with the program this year.
Definitely. I think we'll announce our award winner on the day of, during the convocation. But mm-hmm. our MLK Award is targeted for somebody in our community that is doing the work that Dr. King championed. It's about somebody that's going to come in and they're putting their money where their mouth is. They're putting their energy where their mouth is. They're putting their scholarship where their mouth is and pushing for justice in a really, really strong way. And so this year, I am excited about our winner and can't wait till our campus community gets to share in that as well. Our winner this year is doing work in this region that is literally shifting the way our region interacts, sees some of the least of these in our region, and the way they think deeply and critically. And doing that while also shaping the minds of our students to think and do the same thing. And so excited for our winner this year, excited to announce that.
Well, there were some great past winners, too, we should mention. This past year, 2017, it was Professor Heath Carter while he was here on campus.
Yeah. While he was here, we had Heath, who helped guide this process the last couple years. We've had individuals that have done things from an international lens, such as Chuck Schaefer, such as Hugh McGuigan. We've had ministers and great pillars in the community, such as Reverend Greg Jones, who has won before. And then, I think of Lou Jean Walton, who has just done some incredible work in this area. All these winners are representative of what we have here in this region in terms of pushing for justice, right? We're not reaching outside of the region. We're not bringing somebody in. These are folks that are doing this work here that folks can come alongside and work with. And they're still doing this work. A lot of them are. And to tell you the truth, I think one of the greatest things that we'll have, we made an addition to this year's schedule, is that we added a play this year. So historically, we've done a movie before. We've done some donor dinners. But this year, we decided to say, let's be more inclusive. We want something that everybody could engage in. And we added a play, a very renowned play by Katori Hall, mm-hmm. Entitled The Mountaintop, which is a fictional retelling of Dr. King's last night here on Earth. It takes place at the Lorraine Motel, and it's about his experience basically encountering an angel in his presence, even though he didn't know it, and how it explains and really demonstrates Dr. King's humanity while showing how human he is. It also shows that folks that are human can do some important and necessary things in our world, and it really hits everybody where they are and pulls them to where they could be in a really strong way.
Do you think that, especially with this movie, or this play, excuse me, that's coming up as part of the program at Valparaiso University this year, do you think this is in part the way that Valparaiso University likes to get the community involved? I know a lot of times in a lot of communities, Martin Luther King Jr. Day turns out to be almost like a day of service, which is not quite what it is. That's more befitting to, like, United Way, where they get folks involved in the community in some hands-on experience of some kind. Do you think this is much different than that? Maybe taking it to the next level?
Yeah, I think it's different. I think one of the things that we're very mindful, we're a very service-bent institution at Valparaiso. Our students are involved in several hours of community service throughout their time there. It's actually kind of sewn in to our presence there. One of the things that we have to take time and make sure we're doing is that we're having the hard discussions. And one of the things that sometimes days of service turn into is that we love to go out and do service for individuals because we're able to do it for them, and we never address what is causing the issues that's creating the situations that need the service. We never actually have a systemic conversation about what is actually happening that makes this service necessary and needed. Why are people not having the ability to have homes and affordable housing in Northwest Indiana? Why is that a conversation that we still need to have? You know, we can go out and do the Habitat, which is important work, highly important work. But if we don't actually take some time and have discussions about what's causing some of these issues, we're only going to be in a service mentality and will never move to a justice mentality, which is a recreation of the system and the structures that are propagating our society. And so that's what today, that's what this day is for us at the institution. It's a day for us to actually have those tough conversations that typically people shy away from.
Well, Byron, if anybody would like more information about the Our Time celebration, the convocation that's all going to happen on Monday at Valparaiso University, where can they find out more now?
Yeah, definitely. Please come to our website, valpo.edu/MLK, and it'll give you the entire schedule, allow you to hear more about our speakers, and register. Registration is free unless you're coming to the luncheon, and the luncheon is a $12 cost. But other than that, the entire day is free and open to the community. So please register and come on out. We just need the registration so we can make sure we have enough chairs in the room. We want to make sure we can accommodate all the folks. And so please go there and register. And if you have any questions, there's contact information on the site, and you can get in contact with us, and we'll answer any questions that you'll have.
That's valpo.edu, and you can go on there, look on the university website, and then you can find the specific pages for the Our Time celebration and convocation that is coming up on Monday. And Byron, thank you for joining us and explaining in great detail, certainly expanding on what the entire day, what the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day is all about, at least as far as Valparaiso University is concerned.
Definitely, definitely. Thank you for having me.
You're
welcome.
Byron Martin is Executive Director of International and Intercultural Engagement at Valparaiso University, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Building Northwest Indiana, and here's your host, Kevin Comerford.
Last week on Building Northwest Indiana Radio, we started a conversation with Roman Bronson, a union journeyman electrician, as well as the Northwest Indiana Coordinator for the Indiana Plan for Equal Employment. Just to recap, the Indiana Plan is a not-for-profit organization which helps to address the problem of low minority participation in the union building trades. If you didn't catch last week's conversation, it is available at www.lakeshorepublicradio.org. Roman is back here with us today in studio to continue that conversation. Roman, thank you for joining us again today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
Roman, last week you talked about the application process and how to go about getting involved with the Indiana Plan and what to expect if you are accepted into an apprenticeship program. Today I wanted to start off the conversation by asking about what would prevent a candidate from succeeding in the program.
Yeah, no, that's great. You know what? That's a great question. So I would say that sometimes people want to get involved with construction do not realize that there's a real education component to it. That even though if you work hard, but you cannot complete all the class assignments and you have issues with punctuality and those things, you're going to end up being removed from that program. What I would say, there's a preparedness as far as researching these apprenticeships. There's a great website that was done by the Construction Advancement Foundation, WeBuildNorthwestIndiana.com. From using that resource, you can better prepare yourself for what to expect. It's not just about going to work. There's also expectations around education, community involvement, and all these other things. I think just a general lack of research is what's going to really bomb most candidates.
You know, as a union electrician, you've been through the apprenticeship program yourself. Can you talk a little bit about the structure of an apprenticeship program? You know, how does that work? You know, what can an applicant expect if they do get into an apprenticeship program? You know, what's kind of waiting for them once they finish that apprenticeship program?
An apprenticeship program, the easiest way that I think it makes sense for people is to say it's an internship and it's college all rolled into one, where there's a component of on-the-job training. So that means you're going to work, you're getting paid. That's part of that's the intern part. And then there's also a school component where you need to complete these various assignments and keep at least 80% in most apprenticeships. That's the college part. As you move through these various activities. So like my apprenticeship was a 5-year apprenticeship. So I needed to complete 8,000 hours of on-the-job training and 2,000 hours of in-the-classroom training. And as you successfully complete these milestones, you get pay raises, more responsibility at work. There's some certifications that get passed along as well. And once you finish, you end up receiving this national accreditation. We call it being a journey person. It is recognized by DOL as well as the various union trades, and that allows you to go wherever you want to around the country to work and still command your benefits and your wages.
And as you're going through the program, does your pay scale change?
Yeah. So some of those milestones that I was talking about earlier, they correlate to higher wages. Usually with an apprenticeship, it's usually about every 6 months you get a bump up in pay. As long as you, like I said, you have a satisfactory, we call them work reports, but basically they're monthly evaluations, and you maintain at least that 80%. Usually it's around 5% bump up in pay every around 6 months, translate to around $2 to $3. So there's some significant income that can be garnered through an apprenticeship.
And how about benefit packages?
Yeah, so benefits, for the most part, around 3 months after you get involved in an apprenticeship, you become eligible for health insurance, and they're really good health insurance plans. I think if you was to sit down and compare it to some national, some other guys, you would see the value in it, as well as most unions, you start accruing retirement benefits right away. And these retirement benefits are paid by the contractor versus instead of it being a deduction from your paycheck, that means that your employer is paying this on your behalf.
Men and women that are interested in getting into a union construction trade, how do they go about applying? Is there a certain time frame that they're able to apply, or can they apply at any time?
Yeah. So if you are interested in getting involved with the union construction industry, the best way to get training is through an apprenticeship. And every apprenticeship is going to be a little different as far as their application periods. Some take them online, some only take them in person, some is only once a month, some is quarterly. So that's where it really becomes important to do that research. And also with the Indiana plan, the way I like to think about it is that we're here to help you through that process. If you really want to get involved with the industry and you don't know how to go about doing it, the Indiana plan program is tailored to give you the information such as this. When did this particular trade take applications? What are they looking for? And what can I expect through the process?
Well, that'll do it for today's edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. Thanks again to our guest, Roman Bronson, with the Northwest Indiana Director of the Indiana Plan for Equal Employment. For more information on the Indiana Plan, please visit their website at www.indianaplan.org. And for more information about all the trades, you can visit www.webuildnwi.com.
Building Northwest Indiana is made possible by support from the Construction Advancement Foundation. And you can hear Building Northwest Indiana here on Regionally Speaking on Tuesdays, here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And the podcasts of Building Northwest Indiana are also on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I moved to Valpo in 1988. I met Walt Reiner maybe a year before. I was running something called the South Shore Community Unemployment Union. I had determined that what I was going to do was work for the poor, and so I was doing that. In my work with the poor, I ran into Walt Reiner, who was saying that he had done a program 20 years ago to help black families relocate to Valparaiso. He wanted to do it again, and he needed some connections. And so I said, well, you know, I'll check it out, because I still have my socialist leanings. And I said, well, the only thing that's going to help women in this society is wealth. And so owning land in America is an indicator and a criteria of wealth. So if it means that if I could help you get some land, then that means that I can actually literally shift your status with the bank. And so you become a different person from the bank's perspective. I helped women of color relocate to Valparaiso, and they became property owners. By that time, I had gotten married, so I did myself said, well, we'll relocate, because I wouldn't want anybody to go into an all-white, middle-class community and not have anybody there with them. People were being hurt. People were throwing Molotov cocktails. People were painting swastikas. I started a church here 30 years ago. And I remember my kids coming to the back door of the church and saying, what's that? And it's a big swastika on the door. And I'm trying to explain to them why they're trying to get to Sunday school, why folks were painting those kinds of things on the door. You know, we started a couple of organizations to try to deal with it. Most of the time, people try to cover it up, you know, say, oh, it's just vandalism and stuff. I said, no, it's real. And in my mind, I'm still working on revolution, because that means that you're giving status to people who would ordinarily not have it, and thus giving them power and ability to make change. And so that's what I did. That's how I got here.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. At the State House, a bill that would allow certain Lake Michigan beachfront property owners to keep the public from playing on the beach in front of their property. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports that that measure would in turn challenge an Indiana Supreme Court decision.
Several lakefront property owners in Long Beach claim their deed extends all the way down to the water's edge. The bill, authored by Republican Representative Doug Miller, would reinforce that ownership. Jeffrey Hyman is an attorney with the Conservation Law Center, which represented environmental groups in the Indiana Supreme Court case. He says, for centuries, federal law has held that private property owners only own the land up to where the high water mark usually hits the beach, and that can't be changed by a deed or plat map.
If it goes below the natural ordinary high water mark, it has stolen state land and it's unlawful.
The bill would also strip cities and counties of the power to approve the construction of seawalls or control whether homeowners can remove sand and vegetation from their property. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
The county jail overcrowding task force is created earlier within the state court system to do a statewide review of jail overcrowding. And according to the official purpose, as listed in courts.in.gov, the task force is to identify some common reasons and maybe some local, regional, and statewide solutions. The task force did some tours visiting several cities around Indiana during 2019. One of those visits happened to be with a presentation at the Ivy Tech Community College in Valparaiso on October 30th. And Porter County Sheriff Dave Reynolds, among those people who had a chance to be at that session and talk about how the Porter County Jail has been doing. And we have him on the phone with us from the Sheriff's Department in Valparaiso right now. Thanks for joining us on the program today.
Well, good morning. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. And it's an interesting task force and a problem that it seems like has always been with counties in Indiana. No matter what size of county, there's always been a case where there always been too many people clogging up the jails for whatever reason it may be, and then you have to deal with the overcrowding issue. How has it gotten to the point that this county jail overcrowding task force was created?
Well, that's a good question. I think the governor realized that there was a lot of issues regarding all the sheriffs, regarding overcrowded. 1006 that was passed a couple years ago has caused some concerns with the jails. The level sixes that used to be transported to and housed in DOC in prisons now are not. Now they are staying with the jail. So that's kind of posed a little bit of a problem. And so I think the governor was getting kind of getting it from a lot of different angles on what the problems are. Every county was maybe given different problems. And I think he put this task force together to really look at what is the issue throughout the state. And that's what they did. They met in French Lick this summer. They did a tour of our jail. Then they met in Anderson. And then during those times, they had meetings and requested area sheriffs from those areas to come in and present testimony on different issues. And then consequently, as a result, they put together a jail task, the overcrowded task force report. And I'm sure that's why you're calling. It was pretty pretty specific, and they had a lot of good suggestions in the report.
I understand too. Yeah, they had spent some time, and it's not all, of course, coming from the testimony that the members of the task force heard there in Valparaiso. They had the other presentations around the state as well too, but they had an opportunity to talk with a lot of people in their all the regions. As you mentioned, you had sheriff's departments and sheriffs in other parts of the state come in those particular visits and kind of testify about their specific problems. Was it something, I guess it seems that there are, because there are so many cases going through the court system, that maybe it was kind of a combination of things where county sheriff's departments and jails had to work with the courts and all in trying to deal with the overcrowding issue?
Well, that's that's true. And I think, you know, put it in perspective, when we built this jail, when I came in the first time in 99, they had just approved money to build a new jail. And we had, that time, we had around 420 inmates. So when we moved in 2002, we actually had 450 inmates that we brought in. We're averaging right now around 320 to 340. So well, that was one of the questions that the task force asked us, is what's going on in Porter County? How come your jail population is so low? And really the answer is a combination of a lot of things. Our programs in our jail, we keep track of the recidivism, and we're showing that the programs have a direct relationship to a lower recidivism rate for our inmates. So we know it's working, and that's part of the problem or part of the solution. But the other issue, we are one of the 11 counties that was identified with Indiana risk assessment systems, so which means our PAC program, our community corrections, interviews every inmate that's arrested. And if they qualify, they can be released. So that's helped us with the courts. And we accepted that. It was all based on evidence-based decision. So it was all based on information that they were providing throughout the state, that they thought this could be a possible solution to reduce overcrowdedness. And what we're seeing, it did. And it's really helped us. Not to confuse the listeners, that if you commit a violent crime, that doesn't apply.
Oh, yeah.
You still get a bond. But the people in our jail, for the most part, they belong in our jail.
That's the impression I get, is that it's the most serious criminals deserve to be locked up for whatever it is until their case is handled or whatever the disposition of the case happens to be. So they're there for the duration, I guess, as opposed to somebody who just has a more minor offense.
Exactly. So, you know, there's a lot of sheriffs that are concerned. They have the perception that we're being soft on crime and our approach. And then nothing could be farther from the truth. You know, what we're doing is we're being more fair to the person that is arrested, and we're assessing his risk. So if they have a high risk, then they stay in jail. If they have a low risk, have a job, then they're released. And what we're seeing is that they're not being rearrested. So we're putting them in the system. But one of the reasons a lot of jails are having a problem, and you kind of touched on it, is that the courts and the prosecutor's offices are not dealing really well with the reduction of some of these charges. Like it's kind of confusing, but the listeners need to understand, felonies are listed as 1 through 6, so 1 being the most serious, all right, 6 being the less serious. Well, a lot of our 6s are reduced to misdemeanors, okay, with the approval of the court. So it's not really impacting the system. Those people did probably deserve to get their charges reduced, and no one has a problem with that. But in a lot of counties, they're not doing that, and then they have a high level of 6s, where we have a very low level of 6s, and so it's not really affecting our jail population. So the task force was taking all of these things in consideration, you know, when they came in there and did the assessment.
Yeah, it sounds like that the task force was, I guess, with their overall purpose to kind of look at the overall problem and trying to find solutions, make recommendations to the governor and the chief justice and lawmakers as well, as I guess they have to do, which they've got the report out now available for them to review. It was a question, I guess, as to whether they had to, maybe in a particular county, as you say, the prosecutor and the courts had to maybe try to find ways, if they haven't done so already, they need to find ways to come up with a better pretrial release program, which apparently is what Porter County has in place.
Right, exactly. I mean, and what they're seeing, too, is I told the task force what they need to do is there's like 45 counties of the 92 that are overcrowded. They need to look at when these jails were built. Maybe they just need to build a bigger jail. You know, maybe it's not a system problem. Maybe it's not the courts or the prosecutors. Maybe it's just the fact that their jail's too small. And they need to look at that, too. But, I mean, right now, I think One of the things that task force really touched on is that what we really stressed is that our counties are really having a problem dealing with mental health. And we do real well with detoxing alcoholics. We do well with detoxing people that are on opiates or heroin. And we're not asking for any help because we're doing well with that. But what we don't do very well is that we are not equipped and trained to deal with people with acute mental health illness. And there's a big problem in the state right now. So what we're trying to do, and we did a really good job, I think, in explaining it to the task force, because the task force then related to the governor, because the governor needs to address that. And I think he will. And that's what we hope that we'll where the sheriff this year can accomplish is helping with that. Because just so the listeners understand, if I get a court order to pick up someone and commit them to a state institution, they have to sit in my jail at a minimum of 2 to 4 months. Mm-hmm. And that's just unacceptable. And that's the problem. You know, that's a problem not only in Porter County, it's a problem throughout the state. And that needs to be addressed. And the task force report did reflect that. I was really happy about that.
I guess when you talk about the issue of mental health issues and you say that there is a problem and it goes further up the chain, so to speak, I guess it actually goes, I guess, to the institutions, I guess the few that are out there. I know there used to be more and there are fewer institutions that are out there that can handle, I guess, people that come into the system and need the mental health help of some kind or another. It's a question they may have to do some expansion on that end, as well as dealing with crowded jails, too, I suppose.
Right. Well, yeah, I think what they're seeing is the problem with the overcrowded jails is going to be addressed. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, and we're addressing it. What they need to do is either these facilities, these state institutions, don't have the proper beds or they don't have the proper staff. But that's kind of out of our bailiwick a little bit, but it directly impacts us. It directly impacts every sheriff because we deal with this on a day-to-day basis. People don't realize that about 80% of the inmates that we have in our jail have some form of mental health issues.
Right.
You know, if you did it 1 to 10, you know, you have the alcoholics and maybe the people that are addicted to drugs. You know, I classify them like the 1 to 4 or 5. But then you have the 6s and 7s and the 8s that are a problem. But then we have maybe 4 or 5 a year, we have an acute mental health person who's like that I classified as like a 9 and a 10. Well, then we can't handle those people. We just can't deal with them. But we have them. I mean, we get court orders that said pick them up. You know, so it's a problem. I mean, it's a serious problem. But like you said, years ago, we used to have Beatty Hospital. I don't know if you remember that in Westville. That was the mental health facility.
Yeah.
When they closed it, and they made it a prison. But we had it right here, and there was never a delay. Well, now, I mean, now that we don't have the facilities like we once did, and it's a problem. We use Logansport. There's one in Richmond. There's one in Madison. There's one in Vanderburg,
mm-hmm.
in Indianapolis. But there's 92 counties, you know. So, you know, they're going to have to look at that, and I think they are. I mean, in fact, I was on the phone today with somebody from the governor's office and addressing just the same stuff I'm talking to you about. And they've made it very clear that they're aware of it and they're going to do something about it. So I think things will change.
Well, it sounds like, too, that the County Jail Overcrowding Task Force got their job done, got their report turned in to the governor and everybody else that was supposed to be getting copies of this in plenty of time so that some lawmakers can take a look at it. And maybe in turn, they'll get some bills proposed for the General Assembly session starting next month and start to work on some of the issues. And you say dealing with the mental health problem in particular first, because that's the overarching problem that everybody, regardless of the size county jail that they happen to be working out of, is dealing with.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think they did a phenomenal job of putting that together. I mean, you had 2 Supreme Court justices, you had senators, you had the director of the Department of Corrections, you had a sheriff on that committee, and, you know, like what we said, we don't want just a bureaucratic report. We really want some direction, and we want a solution to the problem, you know. And it looks like there's no question they put down this is what needs to be done. What? And that was really encouraging. And I wasn't surprised. I mean, it was very impressive that task force. They came in. They met business. You could tell they're very serious. They asked the right questions, and I think they did a phenomenal job.
Well, I have a chance to ask you here. Were they seemingly pretty impressed with what they happened to learn, or actually get to see there in Porter County?
Well, I was very proud of that. I mean, when we were the only jail that they asked to actually take a tour. So they took a tour of our jail, and we gave them the opportunity to see all our programs and go in the cell blocks and talk to the inmates. And when's the last time a Supreme Court justice was in a jail talking to inmates? But they were very receptive to that, and they went in there and asked the questions and to see what was going on. And they actually firsthand saw our program, sat in the program, watched them and talked to the counselors and talked to what we're trying to achieve here. So I really think, and they also saw what we actually had a person that was being, held on a mental health commitment. So they saw that person. So it really resonated to them of what we were doing. And I was very proud of some of the comments that were made, that they thought that we were the model sheriff, jail dealing with the issues of, and most of our issues are dealing with domestic violence and substance abuse. But they actually came in and talked to those people in those programs. So I think if I was them, I would want to see that. You know, I mean, you can read about it, but when you actually go in and see the programs taking place, have an opportunity to talk to the inmates and get their reactions and their responses, I think it put a lot more meaning to what we're doing here.
Well, if anybody wants to take a look at the Jail Overcrowding Task Force 2019 report, it is out there. It's available to look out online at courts.in.gov. And Sheriff Dave Reynolds, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about the process that you and some of the other sheriffs involved with the County Jail Overcrowding Task Force went through this year. And it's so nice to know that Porter County got some good reviews out of it as well. And thanks for spending time to talk about it today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. A Maryville High School senior has picked up a big scholarship to be able to work for his goal someday of starting his own restaurant. Xavier Thompson is with us as well as with his assistant principal, who's Michael Naki with Maryville High School. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us on Regionally Speaking today to talk about a very interesting topic as well as a great opportunity to learn something very important for your lives.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Xavier, if you will first, tell us a little bit about yourself. There's a personal interest in culinary arts, which is what the $17,000 scholarship that you have been awarded from Johnson & Wales University is all about.
I've loved culinary for years, for a long time, since I was 12 years old. And so when I actually came to Maryville, when I went to guidance, they actually told me they have a culinary pathway. So I told them that I actually really like culinary. I wanted to make that my career. And so they put me on that pathway.
That's very interesting. And I guess it goes back to your experiences with cooking and the like, go back to family members, I guess your grandmother. I understand that's what got you really interested. How did you get a chance to be able to help cook with your grandmother?
Well, I was basically over there pretty much every weekend, and we always made breakfast every morning. And I just realized at one point that I really liked making food with her and basically with all the women in my family because they're all really good cooks. It's strange, actually, how good of like cooks they are, but they really inspired me, especially my grandmother.
Well, you shouldn't be surprised because grandmas tend to do that. That's what they do best, it seems like. That and writing herd on a lot of kids, you know, whether it's their own kids or the grandkids or whatever. It's all part of being a grandmother, I guess. But it was did you find it interesting that what she taught you, even just something simple as cooking breakfast for the whole family, was something that could perhaps direct you into a career like this?
I was really surprised when I realized that was something so simple, and yet now it's going to turn into a career. I have a scholarship for it, so it was really surprising how far I got.
What got you interested in Johnson & Wales University? That's in North Miami, by the way, so you're talking Florida. You're talking a long way away from Northwest Indiana.
It was actually my culinary teacher, Miss Tubbs, who inspired me to go to this college. She has a pennant on her wall from the college.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked that college up and I thought, okay, yeah, this is a pretty good looking college. And then she had a representative from said college come and talk to the entire class. So that really set me forward to Johnson & Wales. Like, that really set me there on that pathway towards Johnson & Wales.
Now, Xavier, I'd like for you to talk a little bit here in just a moment about the culinary arts classes that you took and everything that you had to learn to get you to this point. But, Mr. Naki, I would like for you to talk, if you will, please, about the CTE pathways. That's short for College and Technical Education Pathways. Tell us a little bit about that program that's set up there at Maryville High School and some of the other pathways that are available for students to follow through into some career possibilities.
Absolutely. So a couple years ago, we decided to become our own consortium. We used to be affiliated with the Gary Career Center, and with the direction of Indiana Education of what was taking place, we thought we could better serve our students by having our own pathways here instead of sending students out. So we set up the culinary arts program about 4 years ago. We've been building up ever since. And Ms. Dubs has done an excellent job of her classes and getting students involved and getting opportunities for students to get scholarships, as well as obviously getting to college and finding job market opportunities. But we have a ton of pathways, and actually our problem is we're trying to narrow down our pathways down to about 23. So I'll list off a couple of them.
Okay.
So, in hospitality and human services, culinary arts is one, but we also have hospitality and management, as well as human and social services. We have a different cluster with public safety where we offer criminal justice classes for students who want to become police officers or maybe even attorneys. We have a fire and rescue class, which is really neat that we're building up here. For manufacturing, we offer welding as well as robotics. So I'm going through here, trying to think. For our STEM classes, for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, we have computer science and programming, as well as PC support and information technology. And for transportation, we have automotive services. And, right now as a school, we're looking for opportunities to send students out and to work with different businesses. We have partnered up with different facilities. Just for example, with our automotive services, we have students going over to intern at Bozak Motors over on Route 30 so they can learn new skills over there. We have a whole host of different pathways, pretty diverse. I mean, we have a really diverse population here at Maryville, and we try to service those needs to get kids interested in different fields so they could get a job once they get out of here, as well as we offer different certifications as well in each of the pathways.
Now, Xavier, let's come back to you. Talk about the certifications that you were able to earn through your culinary arts classes there at the high school that will in turn get you ready for going into the college life in Florida.
Going through that pathway, I was able to earn my ServSafe certification, which is basically the safety and sanitation requirements that I need to actually work in the culinary field. I also earned a certification in the ProStar Culinary Arts Program, which is basically dual credit, also through Ivy Tech, which I got my credits for. So basically when I go into Johnson & Wales, I will already have at least 3, maybe 4 credits that I already need.
That's great. That's great to hear. It's always tough to be able to pick up enough credits ahead of time so that you can shorten your class load, especially when you go to college.
Right. I was actually pretty proud of it that I was able to get those credits, so I would spend much shorter time away than I needed to.
Well, now briefly, what do you think that you feel that you can take out of not only what you've learned at Maryville High School, but what you're going to learn as well later at Johnson & Wales University, that you'll be able to turn into something that will get you into the opportunity to be a really, really good restaurant owner and operator?
Well, I guess beyond the culinary aspect of it, I was really hoping to learn about, you know, different cultures. I think culture, especially in food, is extremely important to learn. Different cultures make different foods. So me taking that away from not only here, but college will be a pretty useful tool in my restaurant going into the culinary field.
Do you think that you're going to be a good restaurant owner, or that's your goal, I suppose, is to be the best that you could possibly be?
Oh, yeah. I'm confident that I'm going to be a pretty good restaurant owner. People love Italian food. That's what I'm going to be making. So, yeah, I think it's going to be really successful. I think it's going to be really great.
Well, Xavier Thompson, thank you very much. And the best of luck to you, not only in your coursework coming ahead with your scholarship from Johnson & Wales University in Florida in culinary arts, but your life is a restaurateur. And Michael Nockey, the assistant principal at Maryville High School, thank you for spending time to talk with us, too, about the CTE Pathways program. And we hope that there are many more students like Xavier who can follow through and have some great careers in their lives ahead. Thank you for talking about it today.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll be back with you tomorrow here on Lakeshore Public Radio.